He's a noted researcher of rural America and says people have a bullheaded attitude towards the government and economy.
If you have too little government, you'll have too little economy. If you have too much government, you'll starve out or you crowd out part of the economy. But too little government yields inevitably to too little economy.
Hello, I'm Paul Yeager, and welcome to the MTOM podcast, a production of Iowa Public Television. David Swenson is a regional scientist based at Iowa State University. We discuss Kansas, regional trade centers, and the health of rural America. But first, this former triathlon competitor discusses his workout regimen.
Are you a morning runner, an afternoon runner, and how many miles have you done so far today?
Go out at 4:45 in the morning with a dog and five miles.
Every day?
No, not every day. I'm getting old, so I have to start preserving the knee. I have one bad knee. I actually have to wear a device.
Oh.
Yeah, so I have to protect the knee. So I have to mix up running and walking now. So I do two walking days and four running days.
Is it all outside or
yeah,
are you an inside guy?
Good Lord, I'm not going to run inside.
So when you're like a day like today that's pretty brisk, I think you've told me before you really are bundled up to start.
Actually, I'm usually kind of underdressed.
Yeah, really?
Really. I've 15 degrees this morning with about 5 degrees with wind chill. Went out with a long sleeve shirt, a nylon vest, cap, and gloves. That's all you need. It's worse to be too hot than to be too cold.
And you don't want to sit and hold on to something that you had to take off because you overdressed.
Right, yeah, if you get too hot, you get uncomfortable and you can't run.
What do you think about when you run?
Everything. It's just, it can be solitude, it can be the stars, it could be why my dog has to poop every 100 meters.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. It just, yeah.
Do you think about work?
No.
You don't?
No. Mostly I just exist.
Because some people will say, I use my physical activity to process something that I'm thinking about. And I now have clarity when I get finished. That's not
no,
that's not
mostly.
You
know what happens when I go to run? 9 times out of 10, a song will come in my head, and I'll just simply have a song in my head. But it's just solitude. That's it. It's just a period of solitude. Yeah, you think about stuff, but when you're running, nothing holds very long because you're having to attend to what you're doing. So you can't hold thoughts for long periods of time. At least I can't.
You can't.
No, I can't.
It's not one of those, I've got a piece of paper and I have to stop and write something.
No, I do that in my sleep. The processing work happens in my sleep. I used to do math problems in my sleep and then wake up with the answers.
Really?
Yes.
And you still felt like you got a good restful sleep?
No, I hated it.
Yeah.
But now I don't do so much math, it's not a problem anymore.
What do you say that you do mostly now? What is
my job?
Yeah,
My job has evolved here at Iowa State University, where mostly what I do is a set of what are called community economics analysis education. The whole idea is to help people understand what's going on in Iowa's economy, not the way an economist would study an economy theoretically, micro, macro, but what are the practical aspects of what's going on in the economy. Where is the state growing? Where is it not growing? Why is it growing? What are the consequences of growth or decline? What are the consequences for communities? Within those communities, what are the consequences for workers? And a combination of both economics, we call it regional science, which is a bundle of political science, sociology, economics, and planning. You try to put it all together. So it's a combination of economics, helping people understand what's going on, as well as demographics, explaining to them the social consequences of change and what might be the implications of that. So lots of talking. We do lots of studying. We work with communities, but we also do lots of talking. I go out and talk to lots of different groups. I get lots more opportunities when the economy's in bad shape. And I don't know, people aren't really interested in what I have to say when the economy's in great shape. I get a lot of people asking me to explain things that are going on, especially during the Great Recession. Those are the kinds of outreach that I do. Lots of service organizations, lots of an occasional trade group will want their quarterly or annual meeting. They'll want someone to talk about the economy. Tends to be either rural groups or finance groups that bankers.
Yeah, like a county banker group or something like that.
That's exactly right. Or something that the bankers have sponsored. It might be Ag Appreciation Day in the springtime or something like that, and they'll bring you in for a general overview. I'm not a cheerleader. I tell them what's going on.
I was just going to ask, are you one that brings them up or keeps it real?
No, I tell them what's happening. I tell them what their facts are. If they've got good, happy stories to tell, I encourage them to tell one another those good, happy stories. But my job is really to try to help them understand what's going on. If I go across the state of Iowa, if I hold away all the metropolitan areas, the non-metropolitan areas in Iowa aren't doing very well. The larger non-metropolitan areas, like the Fort Dodge and Mason City and Clinton and Burlington and Keokuk and Ottumwa, Cherokee, Spencer, you know, they're regional anchors, mm-hmm. but they've not recovered very well from the Great Recession. And some of them are really, really struggling and have been for quite a long time. So we have this impression of Iowa. You're hanging around Des Moines, everything looks booming. If you're hanging around Iowa City or even Cedar Rapids, it looks good. It looks dynamic. It looks like all kinds of growth is going on. You get just a few miles outside of town and you find out things aren't so good. These are the places that we do more of our work with. That's the areas that I study more of. I don't have a solution. What I'm able to do is help them understand what's going on and also help them understand that what's going on in Keokuk and Ottumwa and in now Clinton and some other places, medium-sized trade centers that are not thriving, is something that's going on all across the Midwest. This is a historical pattern of manufacturing-dependent medium-sized cities that over time, that community, its footprint grew. Its social footprint, the number of houses required to support the workforce. But as time went on, those industries needed fewer and fewer people. So you ended up with a bunch of private and public infrastructure that's bigger than the workforce can support. And you have these cities that are in this decline, and they're blighted, and they're struggling to reinvent themselves. And it takes decades for that to happen. Sioux City has been through that process. Maybe it's been a 40-year process with Sioux City. If you think back in the 1970s into the 1980s and the farm crisis and the meatpacking industry changes and all of those, Waterloo is another city that's going through the very same process. The distinction between Waterloo and Cedar Falls, even though they're hooked at the hip, they're two different dynamic cities. One is struggling. One is growing smartly.
One people want to move to. The other one they want to avoid.
They want to avoid, or they're having trouble figuring out why to move there. And it's a function of their regional economy. These medium-sized metros are reinventing themselves. Dubuque is reinventing itself. It's trying very, very hard. It's still a manufacturing-dependent county, but it wants to be something else, and it's invested heavily in its downtown renovation and its riverfront activities and recreation and entertainment, and it's trying to attract high-tech, high-skilled kinds of employment. You know, time will tell whether they're going to be successful, but that's the formula. That's the formula, because you're not going to attract more manufacturing jobs. We're not going to swing for the fence and hit. We're not going to get Toyota. We're not going to get all of these pie-in-the-sky dreams that many of these economic developers say, you know, we're contenders. No, you're not. No, you're not. You haven't been for 30 years.
Could be used as a pawn against or a negotiation peg against another city. Well, you know, this town, Dubuque is going to give us 6%.
Well, that's a common ploy.
And the other one will say, all right, well, then I guess I have to give you 4.
Yeah, and Iowa's,
or on whatever the issue is.
Iowa is already known as a city that's easy. You know, if Iowa was in a poker game, I would play every time.
You would play against Iowa?
Oh, you bet. You bet, because I'd walk away with a lot of money. All you got to do is bluff them.
Do you think that other states around us are that same way?
Oh, sure. They're not quite as inclined towards maximizing the amount of economic development incentives and the sort of going all in on any kind of opportunity, I don't think. It's a range of abilities. Illinois seems to be somewhat like Iowa in the sense that it has bid an incredible amount of money for some minor gains, as far as I'm concerned, but nowhere like Iowa with the Iowa Fertilizer Company or some of the
Apple.
Or Apple.
Those are the two that are going to hang around the necks of people for a long time.
They are, and I've written extensively about both of those, that they were really, really poor public choices. Other states don't have the money.
I should, before I let you go, just to let some people let some people know, the fertilizer plant, Keokuk, Iowa, Lee County, mm-hmm. near Keokuk, There's an argument that that was a political ploy only by Governor Bransett, because that's the only county he never had won in all of his years of running for governor. And there were some critics, cynics, whatever you want to call them, that said that's why they put the plant there and gave such good incentives to move it there.
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons for that. The reason the plant is there is because it's smack dab in the middle of the most valuable farmland in the world. On the Illinois side and on the Iowa side. And guess what? Fertilizer's heavy. You don't want to put your plant someplace centrally located. So the plant was always going to be there. It's wanted to have superior access to transportation. It probably needed to be near a major natural gas pipeline, because you got to have natural gas to do this. So there are all kinds of logistics. But there was also a lot of federal money for developing in that area. And so there was access to a tremendous amount of federal subsidy, matched by a very high amount of state subsidy, matched by an extremely high amount of local subsidy to support 180 jobs. We're talking in excess of $500 million worth of subsidy for 180 jobs. That's not economic development. That's economic development malpractice.
So what happens – because do you think that plant could have gone 30 miles to the east and gone into Illinois?
Well, that was a threat, wasn't it? They said that they had a bid from Peoria, even though there was no evidence that there was a bid on the other side of the river. Not only did they work Iowa against Illinois, they also worked Lee County against Scott County. At the same time, I got calls from Scott County, from people in Scott County up near Walcott, wanting me to do an analysis of what would be the impact if they lost that much farmland, because that was the threat that it would come up and take that much farmland.
Right, and Scott County, Iowa, usually considered the most expensive farmland in the state of Iowa.
It is, so they were working Lee County against Scott County. Classic. We expect this every time. Economic development, in the way it's done nationally, it's an asymmetric discussion. The plant knows everything. The economic developers, the city, the county, they only know what they're told. And they're told very, very carefully. The other thing that the plant knows, it knows where it wants to be. So it already knows everything. What it doesn't know is the degree to which it can manipulate local governments or state governments in support of basically underwriting their investment.
Because they've done their due diligence to know, okay, we think we need to be here or here or here.
Yep.
We've got options A, B, and C. We really know we want A. Let's see what A is going to give us, and all of a sudden, wow, you're going to give us this?
Yeah.
You're going to give us this?
Or we'll go to B, because B gave us such an offer, it offsets the disincentives that would have otherwise existed between A and B.
I've talked with you about this type of thing for years, and at what point does a city, a county, a state pull out of offering these types of things? Because they never feel that they can pull out of the incentive offering game, because the plan is going to go somewhere else.
Yeah,
but the jobs are going to go somewhere else. How do we ever end that?
Well, we've been arguing and talking about this for years and years and years, for decades now. First off, one of the problems, and you just mentioned it, we've been doing this over and over and over again. What happens is you give what's called the standing offer. Last offer you made was the standing offer. So you keep ratcheting up this process over time. The offers get sweeter, the offers get better, and it's harder and harder to justify saying no to somebody. The way economists will look at it, the way that they'll look at it much more broadly, is they'll talk about cities and states and a race to the bottom, that as a consequence of gutting your ability to generate local public goods, public services, you undermine your capacity to support economic activity. You diminish the quality of your schools. You diminish the quality of your shared infrastructure. You become a place that somebody starts to avoid with regard to economic development as opposed to be attracted to, just by virtue of the paucity of public goods. We can argue at the state level that's what's happened in Kansas. From 2011 until now, basically Kansas was a great big experiment in supply-side economics, trickle-down economics. The whole argument was that if we cut taxes enough, we will stimulate enough Kansas-based investment that we're going to get that revenue back. And Kansas demonstrated clearly what nearly every economist knows, that that's a fool's errand, that you never do that. And the problem with it is that people have this bullheaded attitude towards the economy and government, and they don't acknowledge that government is a valuable part of the economy. If you have too little government, you'll have too little economy. If you have too much government, you'll starve out or you crowd out part of the economy. But too little government yields inevitably to too little economy. And people don't see that. They don't price value and internalize the worth of that big bundle of public goods. Some of it is the investment that made it so that you and so that I and so that our children can be part of the workforce and can be leaders in the state of Iowa. There's a lot of short-term thinking and a lot of what's government doing for me.
Mm-hmm. Now, before I answer my follow-up, I'm going to do this. Hold on. Okay. There, that'll be a little better. You talk about Kansas. The current Secretary of State, who's running for governor, thinks the state hasn't gone. The reason that tax plan didn't work is they didn't cut enough. They needed to cut more. And you and I both saw what happened last year. It came to a head, and there was changes in the state house. There were actually Democrats or moderate Republicans, which are Democrats in the state of Kansas, elected because they didn't feel that it was working. But the guy running for governor thinks they need to keep going further. What happens if he wins and succeeds and goes further with taxes?
Yeah, I don't know that he can go further, but what we can see, we have other examples. We can see what Bobby Jindal did to Louisiana prior to him leaving. There was the same thing, basically widespread cutting of public services, leaving the economy and the public sector in such dire straits that it's really on a long-term recovery process. We're talking 8, 12 years for Louisiana to get back on track. If he wins, what you're going to see in Kansas, I think, is an epic battle between the legislative branch, the judicial branch, which has had to mediate much of this, as well as the governorship. To say that Kansas didn't succeed because we didn't hurt the economy enough is bizarre. But that's exactly what you're arguing.
But you've read it and you've seen the argument.
Yes, I have seen the argument. And again, it's this article of faith, this libertarian article of faith that says, government really interferes with the economy and that we really just need to get it down to the basics. And we really ought to let the private sector do much, much more. I don't know where to go with this other than we have a long history of many kinds of ebbs and flows in terms of how large government is with regard to state-level activity. And there seems to be some sort of happy median. You have a state like Minnesota that's considered a little bit more taxy than Iowa. It's outgrowing Iowa like crazy right now.
And why is it working?
Because Minnesota has a bundle of many things. It has natural resources that we don't have. It has a heritage of technology and technology development, so it attracts really high-skilled people, especially young people. It's made up of more industrial sectors that are rapid growth versus Iowa, which is dominated by both agriculture and manufacturing, which are slow growth industries. And so, it's inevitable that they're going to grow more rapidly just by virtue of their industrial composition. But it's a state also that historically has been a higher tax state across the board. But when you're in Minnesota, at least it's always been my experience, you can see what you're getting for your tax dollars at the local and at the state level, generally considered high quality public goods. You flip it around, you've got a slower growth rate down in Missouri. You go into rural Missouri, you don't see much, you know, in terms of public infrastructure and social infrastructure. You can tell the difference between rural Missouri and rural Minnesota.
Well, and I think about that driving. I've driven through rural areas of both of those states, and I am sitting here thinking about Minnesota, and it's different. But that also could be tied to every town's got a lake, and that becomes that recreational side that you're speaking to, and people put money into that economy because they drive there, they have a home there, whatever. It's not quite the same in Missouri.
Well, it is. No, Missouri has a lot of lakes, and they have woods, and they have hiking, and they have mountains. They have things that Minnesota doesn't have. And when you have 10,000 lakes, nobody's visiting from nearby to go to your lake. Everybody's got their own lake in Minnesota.
Right.
So the tourism is primarily internal to the state's economy. It's just that simply the value of those amenities are an attraction for the state.
So why is it that I read that Iowa leaders want to follow what South Dakota has done,
yes,
and not necessarily what Minnesota has done?
Yeah, isn't that something? I'm from South Dakota, and one of the things I know about growing up in South Dakota, when I say a paucity of public goods, I really mean it with regard to South Dakota. It's a property tax dependent state, to a degree sales tax dependent, lots of local option sales tax. It's a regressive tax system. It's a state because of tourism, people coming through Interstate 90 and heading out to the Black Hills and Waldrug, of course, and the Corn Palace.
Mm-hmm.
The state does depend a lot on exporting that sales tax, both the gasoline and the sales tax, to non-residents. But it's a state that's classified as a low public goods state. The teachers in South Dakota either are ranked 49th or 48th in terms of average pay. There are lots of reasons why you would not want to emulate the state of South Dakota. The only places that are growing in South Dakota are primarily in the eastern part of the state, associated with Sioux Falls, the banking sector. That banking sector is not the same as some of the other banking sectors, for example, that you might see in Charlotte, North Carolina, or some other places. This is the banking sector that is the high interest rate, which I'm going to just flat out call the bottom feeders of the financial markets. And they were given an opportunity to thrive in Iowa because Governor Bill Janklow, years and years ago, suspended the usury rates, and you were allowed to basically charge whatever you wanted on your credit cards. And those are the kinds of businesses that are attracted to South Dakota. And again, most of that growth is on the east side of the state. The other parts of the growth that are occurring are on the amenity-rich western side of the state, in and around the Black Hills. The rest of South Dakota is not thriving at all.
When you get off I-90 and not at Mitchell and not at Rapid City, you clearly notice there's not much – there's miles and miles without an exit.
Yes.
And there's nothing on those exits when there is one.
There's towns where when I was a kid working on wheat harvest, we would go to get parts. Those towns don't even exist anymore in terms of having any commercial capacity at all. Yes, there's a big difference between what's growing. University towns in South Dakota and Sioux Falls and the Rapid City, Black Hills area. That's it. That's all that's growing. But it isn't a template for growth. There isn't anything in there that's intrinsic about South Dakota that says that because we did this with regard to our tax structure, we have a superior rate of growth than the Plains average. To the contrary, their tax structure is probably holding the state back from growth. We just did a study, my research partner Lisa Lethington and I, and what we did was we looked at the ability of different states to exchange workers. So we looked at migration over a five-year period in the Midwest, in the Plains, well, actually across the United States, and we measured how the different areas performed. Well, Iowa, as you can imagine, we're reasonably attractive to lower and middle skilled people, and we have a net negative exchange with regard to people who have higher skills. They leave the state. And this is of all ages, not just of college, mm-hmm. just recent college graduates. And the reason is because our economy, as it's configured, can't use all the talent that we produce or that we develop over time. The way our economy is configured, we end up with a surplus of those abilities, and that those people have to go someplace else to find work, to other economies that can absorb them. Well, we're going back to South Dakota. The rate of loss of its skilled talent in South Dakota is extraordinarily high. And again, it's because the nature of employment in that state, the kind of jobs that have evolved in that state, they don't ask for a lot of talent. They're not screaming STEM. No, that's it. They're losing their people. And to the same thing as with Nebraska as well. That's not what we want. What we want is an economy that evolves across a wide range of categories that's able to slowly start holding on to more of those people that we export, and to have an economy that's needs a little bit more higher education levels on average, and enough diversity in the workforce that it starts to hold on to this wide range of people that we can't hold on to.
Well, we're sitting on the Iowa State campus. I think of Iowa State and I think of engineering, computer programming, some of those skills. There's not enough jobs in Iowa to keep all those people here. And those are exports.
That's exactly right.
And that's what you're talking about. We can only have so many teachers because there's only so many schools.
So many actuaries, so many accountants,
right.
so many doctors.
How do you create a job because it's a chicken egg of sorts? Well, they're not staying because there's no jobs. Well, we have to create some type of job. So how do you move that big old boat down to the region of we got to start creating something that they want to instead of just instilling an entrepreneurial spirit?
No, it's a combination of entrepreneurship. That's one thing. The other part of it, though, is our economy slowly evolving to become much more like the national average over time. That means that our older economy, if I think back of an economy that's 60, 70 years ago where you had this half a dozen small towns in every county that was reasonably viable. It was doing okay. And then over time now, we now just have a town or two in every county that at best is holding its own. And I'm talking about non-metropolitan counties. As our economy evolves, as it becomes more urbanized, as we get more development in and around these metropolitan areas, our economy is going to have higher level services like accounting, like healthcare, like engineering, like architecture, a range of business services. As those economies develop over time, you're also going to get other kinds of economic development and entrepreneurial spillovers. They're going to spill out of, well, I'll give you an example. We have this great big thing now going on with Rockwell Collins. It's just been bought up. We don't know where their headquarters are going to go. But Rockwell Collins is full of engineers, full of engineers. Well, those people leak out of that organization and they start new businesses. And so the degree to which those things exist in any one of our major metropolitan areas, the degree to which they're able to thrive or they're able to remain stable, is the degree to which we'll start spinning out those kinds of economic development opportunities. Cedar Rapids isn't going to grow by attracting more manufacturing plants or another big food processor. Cedar Rapids is going to grow the degree to which its business services, its healthcare sector, to the degree that it can exist independently of what's going on down in Iowa City, and a wide range of other technical capacities that exist in that area, the degree to which they can be entrepreneurial. The more that occurs, and it's a slow process, you can't jumpstart it, you can't turn a dial, you can't hyper-educate everybody, mm-hmm. You can't do anything like that. All you can do is go through this process of where the economy slowly becomes more like the national average. And as it becomes more like the national average, then we'll start attracting a workforce that's more like the national average. We're a little bit hamstrung just simply because of the nature and character of our dominant industries.
Should we be teaching entrepreneurial? I don't even know what a toolbox of you can't really create an entrepreneurial mind, but you can help educate it and identify it. Because say I am in, I'll just use myself. Say I'm in the media business. And I don't know anything about running a business, but if I've had those skills in, say, elementary, middle school, high school, it's not as big of a jump. if I'm an engineer who works at Rockwell Collins, I might not know about how to make payroll or how to set up insurance or set up the office, but I certainly have a really good idea to start a company. Mm-hmm. How we can't just say that's a college thing and you get that at a 2 or a 4 year school. Is that something that we should add that to the STEM, make it call it STEM-E? And add an E to make it entrepreneurial with those STEM skills?
I think that's a very, very good point. Iowans are interesting. I have a couple of statistics to throw out at you. One of the things that we think of when we try to get a handle on entrepreneurship and the propensity to entrepreneurship is the rate at which you get what are called business births, startups, mm-hmm. but business births. And Iowa ranks 49th or 50th or 48th. We're really, really bad at the rate of entrepreneurship, business startups. But we're also really, really bad. There's another number, and actually you can call it really, really good, but it's not so good, and that's our rate of business deaths. We rank about 49th, 48th, somewhere around there in terms of business deaths. So if we do start businesses, we tend not to
It doesn't fail
at mm-hmm. anywhere near the rate that it happens at the national average. So there's a certain conservatism with regard to starting businesses, but once the businesses start, there tends to be a higher incidence of viability. Ah, but you put those two numbers together, and it's called a churn rate. It's a churn rate. It's the willingness to take risk. And so you put those together, and we're ranking at the bottom in the United States because Iowa tends to be a state, at least by these aggregate statistics, that really does not have an entrepreneurial heritage. And we know this because our rate of proprietorships in Iowa tends to be lower than the national average, and it tends to only go up if there are proprietorships of stress, i.e. I lost my manufacturing job and mm-hmm. now I've got a couple of side gigs going on. Then I become an entrepreneur. But as soon as they start hiring again, I drop those things and I come back. Iowans like to work for somebody.
They do.
They do. They yeah. just really like to work for – they like benefits. They like to work for somebody. That's one of the characteristics of Iowa that the statistics bear out. It has nothing to do with an observation about their character.
Well, it's in our DNA uh-huh. to be conservative on the sense of I'm not willing to take a big chance. Mm-hmm. We don't take big risks. I think of farmers, though, they do kind of work for themselves. My father was somebody who last took a paycheck in 19, I'm going to say it was 62, mm-hmm. was the last time he took a paycheck from somebody until his death a couple of years ago. That's a guy who never worked for anybody else, and he's not alone. There's plenty of farmers that do that, but anymore, there's fewer and fewer farmers that are that way because some of them have to take a second job. They're either the seed salesman for their count, for their area, they're chemical, I do insurance, I do soil sampling, and I farm on the side. Mm-hmm. That's my vice, yeah. as I'm a farmer.
It's actually much bigger than you're letting on. If we look at the statistics that come from ERS, the USDA statistics, it's the Ag Resource Marketing Survey, a very, very large fraction of household income for farm families comes from off-farm sources. And as a matter of fact, except for the larger farms, the ones that have more than $500,000 worth of sales all the way up to infinity, except for those farms, the majority of household income comes from non-farming. Now, you can say, well, that's because farming doesn't make an income. But no, that they're getting the majority of their income from non-farming. So they do have a mix. They have there's risk-taking on the farm, but the risk-taking and the size of the operations aren't such that it's able to sustain the household. Mm-hmm. And you have one or two other members in that household working off the farm.
My family, exactly, 1985. My mother went back to work.
Mm-hmm. And that's how they got health insurance.
So that's exactly how we got health insurance.
And this was during the farm crisis as well. The way to stabilize – that's one of the ways that people were able to stabilize their communities and their households was mom had to go to work. And we know this. We have very high – the plain states are this way as well. If you look at the participation rates of women ages 45 to 64, we have the higher rates in the nation, North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, and Iowa, much higher rates than the national average. We make our women work.
If it wasn't at home.
That's right. No, I mean
it was off the farm.
And
that's what I'm saying. I mean, they were working so much before on the farm, and then it didn't pay.
It wasn't paying.
So they had to go. And my mom, I'll just bring her in this. She could have been like other farm wives and gone and gotten a waitressing job or a teaching job. But she had a nursing degree. She put the nursing degree work. That put us on a different plane mm-hmm. than a lot of other people. I know plenty of other mothers of folks that I knew whose dad's farms, they were on that waitress level in that service sector. Mom was at a different level mm-hmm. when she got that job as a nurse. And there's – it's a cycle of certain things, isn't it, mm-hmm. That if you can get into that upper echelon and that wasn't a huge moneymaker, but it was much better than trying to wait tables.
Yes, it was. Well, no, that's the degree to which you have those opportunities is also important. You go to Northwest Iowa, more of Iowa's farmers up there work full-time farming, but they're also larger operations. So you and so the majority of their incomes up in those areas will come from farming versus off-farm opportunities. But you go to other places in the state of Iowa, southern part of Iowa, where the land isn't quite as good, the yields off of farming just per acre aren't quite as good. You're going to see much more diversified household employment opportunities. Similarly, if you're near a large city. Again, a higher probability that you're going to work off farm because the pay is so much better in the larger cities. So it depends on your circumstances and your geography as well. We can go back out western South Dakota. You know, you're either ranching or you're not ranching because right. there's no jobs out there otherwise.
Right.
There's just nothing else. But in lots of Iowa, which is so evenly settled, there are some opportunities: education, healthcare, nursing homes. Working for universities or extension, these are all kinds of things that historically what you found is usually the spouse, the wife, working in those jobs and access to health care, which was something that for decades and decades was something that farmers may have struggled, especially as the average age of farmers got higher.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I think of you when I go and spend a week in Fort Dodge for the state softball tournament. Because of what you had said, and you've already kind of mentioned it a little bit here, Dave, it is the hub of the spoke economy. Is that how you refer to – we'll just use Fort Dodge as the example. But when I go the back way from where my hotel is in Fort Dodge to go around up to the softball complex, I know I'm getting close to towns, or if I'm taking the back way, I know towns and I drive through them that might have 100 people, 200 people. A couple of years ago, it came out, and I always wanted to talk to you about this. The Catholics in Webster County have become so few and far between in those small towns that even the whole county was going to have to make a county church for the Catholic Church. Do you remember hearing about that?
No, I didn't.
So the diocese of – I don't know if it's the Des Moines or whatever it was. They said, we're only going to do one. We're going to build this new parish center. All the Catholics in the county, this is where you're going to have to come, is into Fort Dodge. And I just thought that to be a reflection of where we're probably headed economically and what you've been talking about. These other little towns, there might be a Casey's or a Come and Go and a couple of those other towns in Webster County, but the majority of them are in Fort Dodge.
That's exactly right. And these we call these central places regional trade centers. And we have the larger ones like Fort Dodge, and we have the next size down like Carroll. And you get a little
right.
bit smaller, and you get Cherokee, or you get – Creston or Red Oak. These are all regional trade centers. I do a thing when I do presentations, and I tell people a story. And my favorite, I like to use Carroll because for two reasons. I like Carroll, and Carroll likes Carroll. And so when you
that's
put those,
true. That's
you put,
true.
You put those two together, and you can tell this story. And I've done this out in Carroll as well. But I talk about economic recovery. And so during the 1990s, and I'm just going to use general numbers here. During the 1990s, we'd gone through the farm crisis, but during the 1990s, rural Iowa actually recovered a little bit. It stabilized. It got back some of its population. Carroll County added jobs in that county, added nearly 3,000 jobs in that county. And so then I ask my audience, I say, okay, they added 3,000 jobs. By how many people did Carroll County grow during the 1990s? And that's the big question. How many people per job? You know, does a job support a person and a half? People will come up with a number. And the answer is it went down by three. So what was going on in Carroll County is that it was recovering at the expense of all of the surrounding counties. Carroll County became the place where people worked. Mm-hmm. They were taking a paycheck. They were buying things in Carroll County. They were buying things in Carroll. Carroll was doing okay, but it wasn't growing either. And then they were taking those paychecks back home. So Carroll was stabilizing this larger region. And that's the importance of these regional trade centers and in terms of economic development. We need to focus more on stabilizing these places because they're not just important to Carroll, but they're important to that surrounding area. If you go through Carroll at 7 o'clock in the morning on a winter's day, all you see coming from the north is headlights.
Right.
Just headlights heading into Carroll because that is the employment center for that region. It doesn't matter which direction you're going, it's headlights coming into Carroll.
And I think of the same almost Forest City.
Forest City is a good example.
North Central Iowa, they're all coming to Winnebago.
Yeah, and it's not that many people working at Winnebago. But it's still, you see it. It's very, very noticeable.
They come from Hancock County. Yep. They come from Worth County, wherever it is besides Forest City. If you are, I always pin you down on this one. Okay, you've got the ear of legislators right now in the state of Iowa, or any Midwest state for that matter. How do you encourage from a government, again, if the Republicans are in control, we don't want too much government because that's too much overreach. That's their DNA. How do you encourage building a climate where I can take a risk for a business and start something?
Yeah, you know what I start with?
Can you legislate that?
Yeah, you can't legislate it. There are a couple of things, first off. We'll start with the education. And the first part of it is I'm going to bring up a bundle of statistics that demonstrate to them that we're not a high tax state. So if we're not a high tax state, let's not think so much in terms of cutting taxation or reforming taxation. We're a goofy tax state. If you think in terms of how we calculate property taxes for this or for that, or the fact that we have federal deductibility, these are artifacts that make no sense. You can't even find people to explain why they exist anymore, right? I have my theories, but it's wasted on people. So we can clean things up. I argue that a lot of our tax reform could be done on a spreadsheet in an afternoon and make it basically revenue neutral and we're done. Okay, now let's go work on the hard stuff. So the hard thing is what are the necessary public goods and services, one, that we need to provide, and what are the necessary incentives that we need to be providing? Do we need to be underwriting Apple? Or do we need to create opportunities for people to develop homegrown businesses? Might we create more programs that can encourage business expansion? Might we create more programs that help to underwrite entrepreneurship? Might we create different kinds of loan programs that fit within a set of targeted goals that the state says these are the things we need to grow in? And we're going to stick with these growths, but we're going to limit them. We're not going to give this stuff to Rockwell Collins. We're going to give this stuff to Robert.
Jim Rockwell. Who's going to start a business.
This is what we want to try to do. And so we want to get more of them. So what you're thinking of is a bunch of small investments versus, again, swinging for the fence. Stop swinging for the fence because you're just going to whiff.
But when you go out and turn it politically and I'm campaigning for my job, I can say we brought major tech giants. That sounds better in an ad. It sounds better on the stump than it says I helped Jim and Sandy Rockwell start their business. And that's the unfortunate part. It's a lot of things. It's like mental health doesn't get the coverage that it is because you can't understand and tangentially – say I helped somebody with that.
Yeah. You know, the problem in economic development, of the many problems in economic development, is we have so many people who think they're developing the economy. Every single elected official wants to take credit for something that's going on in the economy because they've been conditioned to believe that if they're not saying the words economic development and look what I did and I have a positive attitude, they're going to get hammered. In their elections, they're going to get hammered on TV, they're going to get hammered in radio, so they have to be hyper-positive about the economy. They can't be critical, they can't be circumspect, and that limits their ability to be effective. Democrats and Republicans do the same thing. It isn't just one party or the other. They're all guilty of the same stuff. I don't know what you tell legislators other than your economy can only be as good as the quality of people you have in your state. If you don't understand that, then you don't understand sociology, you don't understand economics, and you don't understand communities. And government plays an incredible role in developing the quality and character of the people in a state. And if you want to cut some of that, there's going to be a consequence to it. And it's almost always economic. And again, we can look. We can give Kansas four more years and see where Kansas finds itself. But what we know, I can graph this stuff from here to eternity, Kansas isn't doing well. And it's a combination of what Kansas did to itself, a self-inflicted wound, and perhaps Kansas just geographically, we can't discount that. It's got both oil and it's got farm dependence.
So maybe it was accelerating what was already happening?
Or aggravating. I'd rather use the word aggravating, okay, perhaps.
So in Kansas, I always think, is that one of those and if Iowa would do the same thing, it's one of those wounds that I cut on the top, but I don't see the damage that I've done underneath, and it's not going to boil up for 4 to 10 years.
It takes a while. The things to remember, though, is it's a combination of what does it do with regard to your propensity to grow. What's Iowa's propensity to grow? It's worst in the nation. Do you think cutting taxes is going to boost that? No. I'm talking about business startups, not overall. Cutting taxes is going to make us now risk averse? Give me a break. That's not what's going on. Our taxes aren't high in the first place, period. That's unarguable. I'll go toe-to-toe with anybody all day long. We do not have high taxes in Iowa. Our tax structure isn't inhibiting investment. It's other things in the state of Iowa. I'm at a loss. And if I was so smart, I'd either be rich or I'd be helping other people to be rich, and I'm not. I don't know how to change a lot of the culture except by giving them good information, making decent presentations, and answering questions to the degree that I can when I'm asked them.
And you lead me right to one of the final things I want to talk to you about. We've gone a few minutes here, and you haven't turned around to your computer and tweeted anything. You recently, you've not been on Twitter more than maybe 2 years?
Closer to five.
Is it that long already?
Yeah.
But it seems here recently you have picked up you are giving us information through your tweets.
Yes.
And stats and surveys and showing a regressive versus a progressive. You're showing us – how do you see what you do, not 140 now, double that, in what your characters are and what you're sending out?
Yeah. The opportunity to use social media, and I primarily use Twitter. I don't use many other platforms, but I primarily use Twitter – is that there are many things that I'm presenting on a day-to-day. I'm putting together information. I'm doing research. I'm looking at a problem. I'm working collaboratively with somebody else. I'm developing a table. I'm developing a chart. And I think, you know, I'm going to go to a conference and I'm going to show this to 40 people. You know, I mean, and that's it.
Yeah.
You know, but I can stick it up and I can tell somebody about, oh, I have one up right now that just looks at the debt-to-asset ratio by the size of the farming operation in Iowa, so that I can help people understand, you know, well, this is what's going on with regard to the farm stress. But there's a lot of difference if you look at small, medium, and large farms. The medium and large farms looking kind of bad. The small farms don't look so bad. You know, the whole point is can I get a piece of information out to help people understand something? We had a conversation in the metropolitan Des Moines area. They're talking about raising a sales tax. Other people are talking about other kinds of a statewide sales tax increase for various reasons. It gave me an opportunity yesterday to try to demonstrate, well, what does a regressive tax system looks like and why is the sales tax regressive? Many people think a sales tax is fair because everybody pays it. But what you try to help them understand is that a bigger fraction of poor people's purchases relative to their income are subject to taxation. And so the sales tax is regressive. There's no philosophical argument about that. It's regressive. You can call it whatever you want, but an economist will call it regressive. And you can't change that fact at all. But the point was, is I wanted to be able to give people an idea what a regressive tax is. I do this with characteristics of the economy and growth and whatever whatever I can give them, either in tabular or graphic form, that maybe helps. Sometimes it's a little bomb being thrown into the middle of somebody else's discussion, you know, but, you know, that's all.
Sometimes?
Sometimes.
Just a little?
Once in a while.
Well, so how do you handle people that respond to you with, you're way off base, you're in an ivory tower,
oops,
and you don't know what you're talking about. You don't have dirt on your fingernails because you're not here on the land.
Boy, isn't that something? Isn't that something? I don't know what I'm doing. I've been out on the road for 30 years in Iowa, studying Iowa, and to tell me I don't know what's going on is just hilarious. I know what's going on. I've been out there. I've been working. And I don't have to have my hand on a tractor to know farming. I did my farming.
Yeah.
I know what I'm talking about. But I'm really not at that micro level. I'm mostly at a little bit of a higher level, the opportunity to help people understand. Look, there are two things that really make us happy in our work. One is being able to show somebody something they never knew. Okay, so that really makes us happy. Oh, here's a way I can characterize this so that you can finally see what I'm talking mm-hmm. about, and maybe it will help you make your argument, or it will make you put the brakes on because you can't go where you think you're going. The other thing that's really fun is definitely proving something's not true that everybody thinks is true. That's the most fun for a social scientist. Many social scientists say, no, we want to prove something. No. It's way more fun to demonstrate if there's a conventional view out there that it's not right.
Well, that's the whole numbers lie,
yes.
You know, and figures. You can make a number. You can twist it to whatever that you want.
Yeah, we have standards, and people will catch you if they catch you misrepresenting information or not scaling it right or not adjusting it for inflation or whatever the types of things that you can be guilty of. We try really, really hard not to ever be guilty of that. We don't cook and we don't skew. We just don't
present.
Do that. Yeah, we present. I give it to you. Now, the choice I make in terms of the numbers I choose and the way I choose to present them always are going to reflect a point of view. We're hoping my point of view is reflective of study, not political bias or social bias or cultural bias. I'm Catholic. I'm not going to put up Catholic statistics. You know, I'm going to simply put up good social statistics from the government that help make the case that I'm interested in making.
Yeah. All right. Well, I appreciate your time. We could go on and on, but I know you have other stuff. And again, we'll just have to come up and visit another time.
Well,
thank you, Dave.
Well, anytime. Thank you.
You can follow Dave Swenson at D.A. Swenson, that's S-W-E-N-S-O-N, on Twitter, or at Market to Market or at Paul Yeager. This is a production of Iowa Public Television. Thank you so much for listening to the MTOM Podcast.